This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2011. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets in the current issue.
This month on the podcast, we're going to hear work by Calvin Forbes.
Black Coon, you know you're too country. You better leave the city.
Spencer Reese.
It was the quiet of the exhausted and the innocent.
And we'll talk with Joshua Megan about poetry and madness.
And if you throw in drugs or booze or whatever, it's likely that more nutty things are going to happen.
Also in this issue, we have poems by Valjina Mort, Susan Stewart, Linda Gregerson, and several other people.
And we have a portfolio of photographs called Seeing Seen by Thomas Sayers Ellis, who normally appears in our pages as a poet.
Every once in a while, you can feel that somebody can actually do another art, you know, as well as they can do their primary art. And that's what I think with Thomas Sayers Ellis, the photos really leap out at you, right, Don?
What's really striking, I think, is that the photos are eloquent in a way that feels like poetry, but they're so different from poems. I mean, Thomas's poetry in particular is very musical, has rhythms from, you know, James Brown in it. And the photographs on the page might seem quiet because they're kind of two-dimensional. But when you see them, when you see the people and what they're doing and the sense of kind of a vocal humanity,
vitality.
The vitality, yeah. You know, street life, and you really feel like you're in the frame with people. And yet, because you're not, you think about them in the way that you would about a poem. You think, What are the voices here? What are the characters? What are the people doing? What are their histories? Where are they going? They fit in with his poetics, and yet they're entirely surprising. Each image is surprising.
And there's an afterwards where he comments on some of the photos, which will help people into them. And aside from that, we've got a portfolio of poems by David Ferry, who's the winner of this year's Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize.
The Lilly Prize is given out once a year by the Poetry Foundation to a poet whose lifetime accomplishments warrant extraordinary recognition. Previous winners include Fanny Howe, Kay Ryan, and W.S. Merwin.
Before we talk about David Ferry, let's listen to him read a very short lyric that helps illustrate some of his qualities as a poet. The poem is called In Eden.
You lie in our bed as if an orchard were over us. You are what's fallen from those fatal boughs. Where will we go when they send us away from here?
I find David Ferry's poems very moving, often because of what they leave out. I have a little introduction here, and I talked about how the contemporary style tends towards a kind of linguistic pyrotechnics, and it really calls attention to itself, and he very much does not do that. His style is muted, and yet there's a seismic power going on in the lines, and you'll get the tiniest little detail rendered with such clarity and emotional heft. It just pierces you.
Yeah. There's an enormous subtlety, too. One of the amazing things about David Ferry's work is that he is as strong in short poems as in long poems. He has poems of every imaginable length, and they all have great subtlety, so that in this poem, In Eden, it's really only three lines with double spaces between them, but he has evoked moments that you may never have thought about, at least I never have, so that there's a kind of expulsion from paradise here. But what you think of is that Adam and Eve have been sent away from Eden together, and he has visualized and articulated the moment of separation that precedes their being reunited out, you know, in the world, in some other world. I've never thought about this before, but there is a moment that separates Adam and Eve from each other.
Oh, she's not Eve exactly, but she is what's fallen.
Yes, she is.
She's the apple.
Yeah,
there is some note of a very poignant note, just as you say, it's a very poignant note of absolute communion and then absolute separateness in the poem. Of course, I mean, if you know some of David Ferry's other poems, talk about him taking care of his wife, who was a famous critic, Anne Ferry, who died of dementia, and he took care of her for a long time. And I mean, it's a very, very sad story. And this poem, you know, presages all of that. Another little poem of his that I love, it's an early poem. It's called Learning from History. They said, my saints, my slogan sayers sang, be good, my child, in spite of all alarm. They stood, my fathers, tall in a row, and said, "Be good, be brave, you shall not come to harm." I heard them in my sleep and muttering dream, and murmuring cried, "How shall I wake to this?" They said, my poets, singers of my song, "We cannot tell, since all we tell you is but history, we speak but of the dead." And of the dead they said such history, their beards were blazing with the truth of it, as made of much of me a mystery. Beautiful poem.
And yeah.
It's a kind of an ars poetica because David is so influenced by the past, and he's translated Horace, and he's translated Virgil, and he's translated Gilgamesh, and you can feel in his work the wisdom that he gains from those efforts, from being saturated by the past, and yet here's a poem that says, despite all of that, I am a mystery to myself.
Yeah. You know? He's a poet who's up to the intimidations of history. So much of the taste for and in contemporary poetry is for, you know, the moment that we live in, the contemporary, the superficial,
yeah,
the things that are on the surface. And for him, history is like with a capital H, but there's no sloganeering here. The rhythms are intelligent even. They stood, my fathers, tall in a row and said, "Be good, be brave, you shall not come to harm." Mm. I mean, that is an oracular but human voice, and it's commanding.
Calvin Forbes teaches creative writing and jazz history at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. It's not very far from our offices, in fact.
Right. And his first book, Blue Monday, appeared in 1974, and we've got two of his more recent poems in the July-August issue.
The first one is called Mama Said.
Mama said, "The slice I ate, I want it back. Those crumbs I swept up, I'd like my share again. I can still taste it like it was. The memory by itself is delicious. Each bite was a small miracle, both nourishing and sweet. I wish I had saved just a little bit. I knew it wasn't a literal cake. It's the thought that counts, like a gift that's not store-bought, making it even more special. Like a dream that makes you want to go back to sleep. You can't have your cake and eat it too," Mama said. I was defiant and hard-headed, and answered, "Yes, I can, too." The look she gave me said, "Boy, I hope you aren't a fool all your life."
Well, it's a terrific poem of being haunted by things, you know, that one of your parents has said to you that resounds throughout your life.
Yeah. Also a very human point. I mean, it echoes a lot of African-American poetry, and I immediately thought of Langston Hughes, my favorite poem by Langston Hughes, which is, "Sometimes a crumb falls from the tables of joy, sometimes a bone is flung. To some people love is given, to others only heaven." It's wonderful, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a poem about those moments that are unrecoverable in memory, but somehow recoverable in poetry. I like the hard-headedness of the end of it. I hope you aren't a fool all your life.
Right.
Let's hear another poem by Calvin. This one takes place in New York City, and it's about a creature that you very occasionally see there raiding the trash cans.
Talking Blues. "Raccoon, you better be cool. Thought I saw you on Broadway eating Kingfisher's barbecue. Some people claim raccoon you pretty, swear raccoon tame like a kitty. But raccoon bites you if you get too close. I saw a raccoon on Lenox Avenue stealing milk from a baby. Thought I saw a black cat on the corner, but it was nothing but an old raccoon. Raccoon, let me school you. Raccoon, you know you're too country. You better leave the city. Raccoon, they got rats in New York City big as you and just as ornery. Nobody in Harlem studying you, raccoon. So you better go about your business. Raccoon, you better get wise. Look what playing possum got to possum."
It's funny to read these right after David Ferry. We say David Ferry has all of history in them and brings this great gravitas to his poetry. But it can also be quite a relief to have poems that occur glancingly and with humor and that aren't setting themselves up as monoliths mm-hmm. for you to admire. You
know? Yeah. It stands in a great tradition, not only of poets like Langston Hughes or Gwendolyn Brooks, but really the city mouse and the country mouse,
yeah.
which goes way, way back in English language poetry. You know, raccoon, you know you're too country. You better leave the city.
So that notion of being in the city, especially people coming from the South up to Harlem and bringing, quote unquote, their country habits with them and how they would fare in the urban areas.
I think I've worked on this poem, I don't know, maybe it's 10 years.
That's Spencer Reese, who will be ordained to the Episcopal priesthood this fall in Madrid. His poems have appeared before in the magazine, but this is the first time we actually have a prose poem from him.
This is based on my father and my father's family, who actually did work on the atomic bomb.
Spencer Reese's father grew up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which was the site of the Manhattan Project, where the atomic bomb was produced. And as the poem reveals, it was a cloistered community of physicists, engineers, and military men and their families.
The Manhattan Project. First, J. Robert Oppenheimer wrote his paper on dwarf stars. What happens to a massive star that burns out? He asked. His calculations suggested that instead of collapsing, it would contract indefinitely under the force of its own gravity. The bright star would disappear, but it would still be there. Where there had been brilliance, there would be a blank. Soon after, workers built Oak Ridge. The accumulation of Semesto hutments not placed on any map. They built a church, a school, a bowling alley. From all over, families drove through the muddy ruts. The ground swelled about the ruts like flesh stitched by sutures. My father, a child, watched the loads on the tops of their cars tip. Gates let everyone in and out with a pass. Forbidden to tell anyone they were there, my father's family moved in, quietly, behind the chain-link fence. Niels Bohr said, "This bomb might be our great hope." My father watched his parents eat breakfast. His father opened his newspaper across the plate of bacon and eggs. His mother smoked Camel Straights, the ash from her cigarette cometing across the back of the obituaries. They spoke little. Increasingly, the mother drank wild turkey with her women friends from the bowling league. Generators from the Y-12 plant droned their ambition. There were no birds. General Leslie Groves marched the boardwalks, yelled, his boots pressed the slats, and the mud bubbled up like viscera. My father watched his father enter the plant. My shy father went to the library, which was a trailer with a circus tent painted on the side. There he read the definition of uranium, which was worn to a blur. My father read one Hardy Boy's mystery after another. It was August 1945. "Time to go home," the librarian said. They named the bomb Little Boy. It weighed 9,700 pounds. It was the size of a go-kart. On the battle cruiser Augusta, President Truman said, "This is the greatest thing in history." That evening, my father's parents mentioned Japanese cities. Everyone was quiet. It was the quiet of the exhausted and the innocent. The quietness inside my father was building and would come to define him. I was wrong to judge it. Speak, Father, and I will listen. And if you do not wish to speak, then I will listen to that.
Well, that's a devastating poem. You know, I tried to find this quote that I was thinking of from George Eliot's Middlemarch, and I did not find it. But there's a beautiful paragraph where she talks about the moment when immense historical events reach right down into our personal lives, and we suddenly feel ourselves touched by what we think of as history. And this poem does such a great job of making you feel that.
Yeah, it's like the, you know, it sounds like making a bad joke, but it's he is experiencing and describing the fallout from this project.
Yeah, and there are all kinds of great images that prepare the way. There's the, you know, where there had been brilliance, there would be a blank, and the ground swelled about the ruts like flesh stitched by sutures. Mm-hmm. Then you see his mother's, the ash from her cigarette commenting across the back of the obituaries.
Mm-hmm.
You get all these things before you realize what the poem is really doing, you know, where its emotional energy is.
Yeah, that quotation almost in the middle of the poem from Niels Bohr, who said, "This bomb might be our great hope." Yeah. And when you just think of the resonance of that for the people who worked on it and their families,
right.
that they were working on it not as something to destroy something, but out of hopefulness,
yeah.
Or that's what they needed and wanted to believe at any rate.
And the language, you know, he does a good job of capturing the poignant corruption of the language,
yeah.
Because they name the bomb Little Boy. And
it's the size of a go-kart.
Right. There were actually three sites where they were doing the Manhattan Project. One was in Los Alamos, and one was up in Washington State, and one was here in Oak Ridge. And I saw the opera Dr. Atomic recently by John Adams, and you know what they call the Manhattan Project was Trinity.
Yeah.
I mean, this just makes your blood go cold.
You know, at the end of the poem, what's amazing to me is when Spencer Reese describes how when the bomb goes off and the families are talking about this event, you know, he says everyone was quiet, and the poem says it was the quiet of the exhausted and the innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And you think how the exhaustion of humanity across the world in the bomb site and the, you know, the silence of that, the quiet of that exhaustion and the innocent, where they have no voice. They've basically been, you know, they have been incinerated.
Yeah.
It's
and, you know, people
amazing.
Say poetry, you know, they doubt the power of poetry all the time, and this really gives the lie to that. The people who say poetry has no power have a crude understanding of what power means and how power is exercised and also spiritual power. And because we get so much about history, but we never get the individual lives, the sensibilities of all those people who weren't making history, who were sort of being affected by it,
or,
you know, making it incidentally.
Yes, and this poem makes no pronouncements about it. I mean, it's talking about the reality among individual human beings that underwrites the pronouncements that get made in their name.
Yeah. Joshua Meegan's poems and prose have been appearing in poetry for several years now. His first book of poems from Ohio University Press is called The Optimist.
In the July-August issue, we have notebook entries from Joshua Meegan on the subject of madness and poetry. He joins us from Brooklyn. Hi, Joshua.
Hi.
Josh, the idea that poets are slightly, if not sort of, you know, totally cracked has been around for a long time, and you talk about it in your essay, and, you know, more than practitioners of other arts, like composers, for instance, you know, we think of poets as being mad. Do you think it's just an old romantic idea that modernism and even postmodernism haven't been able to kill off?
Well, I think it goes back further than that, but I should say first I'm not an expert on the subject, I guess. But I also think that it really got picked up during Romanticism, and I tend to think of modernism and maybe even, you know, postmodernism as sort of incarnations of Romanticism.
I guess we're all somehow intrigued by crazy poets, and you admit your own attractions to them. So who are your favorite crazy poets?
I guess, okay, the first person who comes to my mind is John Clare. I also love Cooper. I love The Task, unironically. I think it's a great poem. I love Smart, the much anthologized piece, My Cat Jeffrey. I like Blake, but Blake is not one of my favorite poets. I like Songs of Innocence and of Experience, but I guess I tend more towards the experience side of things.
Yeah, he's pretty sane in those.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. The longer, the prophetic things, I'm not a big fan of. They seem like science fiction to me. But. Yeah.
Now, you note that many sane poets from Eliot to Ginsberg and Ashbery to Jory Graham have forged styles that echo the dislocations of madness. I'm quoting you there. Why do you think that is, first of all, and do you find those styles effective?
It seems to me that it probably, is just a sort of a natural evolution from a sort of, I'm not sure I like this word, but meme or something that began with Romanticism. And I do think that those styles or strategies are valuable and interesting for a lot of reasons. For instance, I wrote a review of a Stephen Edgar book in an issue of Poetry, and
Right. There's
a brilliant poems, but they're highly elliptical, a lot of them are. And one of the things that accomplishes is that when you suddenly become aware of what the poet is talking about, it can be a thousand times more arresting than it would be if you just said it. For instance, you'll be reading along and you'll be saying, what the hell is this poem about? And then suddenly you realize that this glinting in the poem is a machete and he's talking about the Rwandan genocide. But there's a lot of talk about fragmenting your language because that's the only way that you can respond to the modern condition is by using fragmented language in your poems.
Right.
I'm not sure I really believe that. I think that that's an instance of, mimetic fallacy or something.
You say in the essay that actually a lot of your friends are poets and most of them now have had some kind of serious psychological issue.
For sure.
You say only three of these guys that you know, only three have no mood issues or addictions.
So I'm
that I know of.
Uh-oh, I'm looking around the room here.
Yeah, well, the other thing is I had to say three so that, the people reading it who know that they're going to be on the list, they can
right.
be exempted.
Well, so when it comes to poetry now, is there some kind of chicken or egg problem here? Does poetry lead to psychological instability or are psychologically unstable people attracted to poetry or all of this mixed together?
My first impulse was to say that poetry doesn't lead to craziness, but I suppose if a person decides that he or she wants to be a poet, most of my friends started writing probably when they were in their teens or early 20s, and it seems to me that they, and I know I, were for some period fixating on the idea of becoming a poet, and that part of that is being nuts. So, you seek out, or I did anyway, you seek out nutty situations, nutty people, and, nutty things happen to you. And if you throw in a drugs or booze or whatever, it's likely that more nutty things are going to happen. So maybe it does go in that direction.
You describe your own experience in this essay so well. It's so vivid, but it's not romanticized.
Yeah, well, you describe that incident with the milkshake in the essay so beautifully and poignantly.
Oh, thanks.
That stomping on the milkshake. That's crazy, Josh.
Yeah, well, it is a little crazy. Actually, my friend George Green, he's a poet also, he was talking about that last night. He said, I really liked your piece, but I'm a little bit afraid for you that you'll never get a job because there'll be you and one other person up for the job and they'll say, well, okay, and they'll Google you and they'll see, okay, he was stomping up and down in his milkshake screaming, fuck.
No, that'll get you the job.
And that was my wife's answer.
And don't forget, it has the benefit of discouraging negative reviews of your work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, thanks, Josh. Thanks so much for being with us here
today. Thank you. Thanks very much.
You can read Joshua Mahigan's essay and everything else that you've heard on this program in the July and August issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org. Don, you read anything lately you want to tell us about?
Yes, we just got a copy of a new book by Devin Johnston that's coming out very soon. And full disclosure, we've published Devin and I know him a little bit and we've done some work together. But he's a striking and unusual poet. This is a small poem called Expecting. What will she, now a she, trailing clouds yet hearing our muffled voices all the while from this dark world and wide, what will she, mew or bray, as any envoy might derive an embryon from animal or amnion from tender lamb, though tethered to a human form, an embryon in amnion, or bloom of jellies at the whim of storm and tide, the ocean's roar above, around, and then inside.
Yeah, it's a beautiful ear. Yeah. Wonderful ear at work. Yeah. There was a book I've been reading by Michael Palmer. Michael Palmer's been around forever. He's sort of at this point, my grandfather of the experimental poetry. But he continues to be very surprising with his books, and I don't find anything at all stale in this. In fact, I like some of the poems in this book as much as I've liked any of his work. And here's a couple of very short poems. This one's called Poem Against War. She raises both arms to free the clasps binding her hair. That's it.
Wow.
That's the whole poem. Here's a poem called Say. Say that a spider with a death's head crawls into your bed and offers to make love. How explain that you were done with love? And what of death? Poem, don't be so strange.
That's really good.
Yeah, I love both of those.
That's all we have this month. We'll be back in September. Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.